And we'll move on to the next case then, the Nance case. Mr. Schultz. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel for the government, my name is Todd Schultz. I work as an assistant federal public defender in the Southern District of Illinois, and I represent Mr. Nance, the defendant appellant in this case. The district court in this case erred in assessing three criminal history points for convictions involving relevant conduct. The convictions at issue were misdemeanor convictions for criminal trespass to residents and giving liquor to a minor. Relevant conduct is conduct that is considered part of the instant offense, and consequently, under Chapter 4, these convictions would not qualify or come within the meaning of a prior sentence, and therefore cannot be attributed criminal history points. These same convictions, however, were considered by the court in the application of the 2G2.2B5 enhancement because the defendant engaged in a pattern of activity involving the sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor. It's of import that this enhancement applies to two types of convictions which involve conduct relevant to the instant offense or convictions involving the instant offense, and convictions for unrelated conduct involving previous instances of sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor. The court concluded that these convictions, based upon Chapter 4 considerations, would not normally accrue criminal history points. But in its interpretation of Application Note 3 to Guideline 2G2.2, it read that application note as mandating or requiring these convictions to, in fact, be counted under Chapter 4. Application Note 3, however, reads that convictions taken into account under B5 are not excluded from consideration of whether they would receive criminal history points under Chapter 4. The court interpreted this permissive language as essentially requiring that these convictions that would otherwise not be countable receive criminal history points. And so the court, I believe, interpreted Application Note 3 incorrectly as an exception to the general rules set forth in Chapter 4. I believe the plain language of the application note is in favor of the defendant's position insofar as the language is permissive. The application note certainly doesn't suggest that the district court must count these prior convictions. In fact, it says that these convictions can be taken into account with respect to Chapter 4. And so implicit in that is convictions considered under subsection B5 can be counted if, in fact, they would otherwise be countable under Chapter 4. There is nothing, then, about the operation of subsection B5 which would prohibit offenses which would otherwise qualify for criminal history points under Chapter 4 from receiving those criminal history points. The history of Guideline 2G2.2 also supports the defendant appellant's position. Amendment 537 made significant changes to this guideline. It went into effect in November of 1996. One of the issues addressed in this amendment was whether conduct which was unrelated to the offense of conviction could be considered for purposes of B5. And the amendment came down in favor of considering those, and the definition of pattern of activity was altered to reflect that, such that unrelated conduct of past sexual exploitation or abuse could be counted and could, in fact, trigger the enhancement. It's worth noting also at that point the appearance of Application Note 3, which discusses the fact that these convictions can be considered as well for under Chapter 4 to determine whether or not they accrue criminal history points. It's interesting because prior to Amendment 537, my understanding is that the only conduct looked at was conduct that would, in fact, be relevant conduct part of the instant offense, such that this application note was not necessary because Chapter 4 would automatically prohibit those convictions from being considered. However, once you begin to look at conduct which does not come within the scope of relevant conduct, that conduct could potentially accrue criminal history points under Chapter 4. And so Application Note 3 appears to be an acknowledgement that double counting is not prohibited in instances where conduct would otherwise qualify for criminal history points under Chapter 4. In the government's brief, it cites to this court's opinion in the Olinger case, and I do not believe that the Olinger opinion is at odds with the defendant's position. Olinger simply indicates that a conviction which is counted under B5, assuming that it would fall within the relevant time period which that conviction did, could also receive criminal history points. I would point this court to the Gothrop opinion, which is cited in the brief, in the defendant's brief from the Sixth Circuit, which addresses a similar issue. But in that case, the conviction which was relied upon, again, conviction for an unrelated conduct, was too remote in time, and so it did not receive criminal history points. And so the court's conclusion that somehow the operation of Application Note 3 creates an exception is not supported by the plain language of the application note, nor is it supported by the legislative history behind 2G2.2. This error in calculating the guidelines is also is not a harmless error. The district court, in announcing its opinion, failed to give meaningful consideration to the guidelines. As this court knows, a district court must not only compute the guidelines, but it must engage in a respectful consideration of the wisdom encompassed within those guidelines. The district court in this case began its discussion of the appropriate sentence in this case by stating that it would throw the guidelines out the window in this case because it could uniquely tailor a sentence without formulaic reliance on numbers. I believe it's significant in this regard that the sentence the district court arrived at, 180 months, this sentence is actually within the incorrectly calculated guideline range that the court found. However, defendant appellant maintains that the correctly calculated guideline range would be an offense level of 29 with a criminal history category of 2, such that the appropriate or advisory guideline range would be 97 to 121 months. And so what you have here is you have a radical upward variance, almost twice what the actual correctly calculated guidelines would call for, and you do not have the district court adequately justifying why such a radical variance would be warranted. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so if there's no questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time.
All right, thank you. Mr. Boyce.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Schultz. My name is Don Boyce. I'm here this morning on behalf of the government. This case arose out of Michael Nance's ongoing illicit sexual relationship with a young girl. It started when he was 25 and she was 12 and continued until when she was 14. The offense of conviction involved his asking her to take pornographic pictures of herself, which she did, and his receipt of those images was the offense of conviction. During the course of the relationship, Nance was arrested for a number of other things, and one of those arrests is his first point of contention. During the relationship, he was arrested when he was caught in her bedroom and was convicted of trespassing and giving liquor to a minor. So the defendant's argument, as I understand it, is that...
I've got a little trouble with the reference to it, both by you and opposing counsel, as a relationship. It's exploitation from start to finish. It's not a real relationship.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is a relationship insofar as there was one person relating to another, but it was
25-year-old to an 11- or 12-year-old.
Certainly child exploitation, and that's what the district court found, because that's what happened.
Is that part of the instant offense where it is what led up to the
Yes, it was the position of both the parties before the district court, as it is the government's position
you,
now.
You've agreed on that, right?
Yes, that, okay. that all of those incidents were part of the defendant's relevant conduct. Right. And I, as I understand the defendant's argument now, is that that prior conviction, because it was part of the relevant conduct, wouldn't normally receive criminal history points because it wasn't a prior sentence as defined in Chapter 4 of the guidelines. And the government agrees that normally that's the case. But you have this carve-out provision in the application notes of the child porn guideline, 2G.2.2. The district court found that the defendant had engaged in a pattern of sexual exploitation, and everyone agreed that he had. The guidelines defined the pattern of exploitation as, this is an application note 1, two or more separate instances of sexual abuse or sexual exploitation of a minor by the defendant, whether or not the abuse or exploitation occurred during the course of the offense. So the definition of what the pattern is clearly contemplates that it can include relevant conduct. So then looking at the next application note...
No, that's not a double charge or something. That's, I'm just trying to make sure how you carve that out.
Well, it would normally be double counting.
But there's... Because of the carve-out exception,
right,
qualifies for that.
Yeah, looking then at the next application note, it says that a conviction taken into account under Section B5, which is the pattern enhancement, is not excluded from consideration of whether the conviction receives criminal history points pursuant to Chapter 4. So what those application notes are saying together is that incidents that occur as part of relevant conduct can also be considered in the pattern of sexual exploitation, and the things that are part of the pattern are not excluded from receiving criminal history points. That's the way the district court interpreted it. I think that's accurate based on the plain reading of what those application notes say. It's also consistent with this court's prior opinion in Olinger. And frankly, it's the application of those notes is consistent with what went on in this case. You had an ongoing pattern of abuse and exploitation where some of the events resulted in other convictions, some of them didn't. And sort of from a policy standpoint, to say that the district court should be able to consider all of that when looking at a case like this, when there is a pattern of sexual exploitation, that seems to be a proper policy and one that was properly applied in this case. If there are no other questions about that argument from the defendant, I'll move on to the next one. No. The next point, the defendant is arguing that another bit of child pornography should not have been included in his relevant conduct, and that is a video that depicts prepubescent children engaged in sex that was found on his computer at the same time as the images of the young girl. His position is that those two things are not closely enough related that they should fall under the definition of relevant conduct. The district court made a factual finding on that the defendant possessed the contested video for the same reason that he possessed the pictures of his sexual partner, and that was for sexual gratification. This court's review of that factual finding would be for clear error, and there's not clear error there. The record strongly supports the district court's factual finding. It doesn't take much of a leap to understand why the defendant would have had pictures of his sexual partner that would have been for sexual gratification. And frankly, most people are repulsed by what's in this video of 12-year-olds having sex, but the only plausible reason why he might have had that would have also been for sexual gratification. So,
do you know which one got in there first? Do you know if the one other than her was there first?
That was there first, Your Honor.
Is the idea that he saw that and then said...
He received that one during the course of his relationship.
I wonder if that inspired the idea, or is there anything?
Well, that's a plausible explanation for what happened later, but there's not any evidence beyond that saying where the defendant had said, "Well, I saw that, and then I decided to get some pictures." But either way, the district court's conclusion that he possessed those things for the common purpose of sexual gratification is supported by the record. The defendant's last argument is that the district court erred in sentencing him based on that comment that the district court was going to throw the guidelines out the window. Looking at the record of the sentencing transcript in the case, it's clear that the district court was doing exactly what it's supposed to do in every case, and that's give an individualized assessment to every defendant, sentence him under the statutory factors based on the facts of that particular case. The district court went to great lengths to describe about how this was a really unique case, which thankfully it is. It would be really disturbing if this pattern were repeating itself all the time. But the district court went through the factors. Well, first properly calculated the guidelines, then went through the factors, commented on several of them individually, and decided on his sentence of 180 months. That's within the guideline range. It's presumptively reasonable. But it really just reflects what's supposed to be going on in post-Booker sentencing. You have the guidelines giving a sentencing range based on their policy and the things that the guidelines have determined over the years, and then a district court applying the individual factors, the statutory factors, to the facts of an individual case, and coming up with an individually tailored sentence. That's what the Gall case demands, and that's what the district court did. The last point I'd make is that the district court made it very clear that even if this court finds that he erred on any of the guideline calculations, he would have given Nance the same sentence. His quote to Nance was, "I can tell you with all impunity, the sentence I give you in this case is the same sentence I would give whether I ruled the other way on all the objections." So the "you" in that was Nance, but for the purposes of today, the "you" in that could be the panel. He's telling the court, "I would have given him the same sentence." Both the Abbas and Anderson cases cited by the government talk about avoiding the pointless step of remanding a case just so that the district court can give the same sentence that he obviously already gave. I don't see how the district court's statement could have been any clearer on that point. So to the extent that there was any error, it would be harmless. If there are no other questions, I would just ask the court to affirm Nance's sentence.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And how much time remains? 2 minutes. Mr. Schultz.
If the government and the court's interpretation of Application Note 3 is correct, it's hard to understand why the language is written the way it is, why it wouldn't simply say convictions taken into account under subsection B5 receive criminal history points. The interpretation offered by the court and the government here renders the language consideration of whether that conviction results in criminal history points pursuant to Chapter 4 superfluous, because it doesn't matter what Chapter 4 says under the interpretation of the government and the court. I would just note that the error in this case was not harmless. What you have here is you have a sentence which, from the defendant appellant's position, is essentially twice that which would have been called for under the advisory guidelines, a case where the defendant contained two videos and eight images containing child pornography. This radical departure, it does not have sufficient justification in the record. When you look at the court's reasoning, the factors it relied on, it evidences the fact that the court didn't look seriously at the guidelines. It talks about the abuse and harm that J.G. suffered and how terrible that was. The reality is that was taken into account under the guidelines and the pattern of activity enhancement, because all of that conduct related to the victim in this case, and that was a 5-point enhancement. The defendant also did not receive acceptance of responsibility, and I believe that that was taken into account and addresses the court's concerns about the offense conduct continuing and his not accepting responsibility. In short, what happened is the court arrived at a sentence far in excess of that called upon the guidelines, because it failed to give any meaningful consideration of the factors already taken into account in the guideline sentence. And a simple statement by the court that it would have imposed the same sentence even if it had ruled differently on all the objections certainly does not give the court's judgment some type of immunity that would make it appeal-proof, especially not in this instance where the court has failed to give any meaningful consideration to the guidelines.
All right. Thank you to both counsel, and we'll take that case under advisement. We'll move on to